And what these problems mean for us as devotees, followers of the Vaishnava philosophy, and what this means, these same problems, for those who don't follow Vaishnava philosophy. Perception in Sanskrit is pratyaksha. And as you may know, there are three kinds of evidence. Whenever there's discussion of philosophy, a discussion of what is real and what is not real, that discussion, arguments must be made on some kind of standard evidence. So there are three praman, or three kinds of evidence, which are acknowledged in the Vaishnava philosophy and many other philosophies. These are pratyaksha, perception, then there's anuman, logic or reason, and then finally shabda. Now shabda of course means for us shabda brahma, the statement of guru, shastra, sadhu. But even in philosophy where there's no particular acceptance of Vedic knowledge, they will still accept the statements of authorities, whoever they may consider to be an authority. This is still going on in the Western world, although the Western, as we were explaining yesterday, the Western tradition has become rather anti-authoritarian, but still, if someone is very great, very widely acknowledged in their field, then what he may say about some difficult subject, that will be accepted, at least by many, many people. So these are the three: perception, reason, and authoritative testimony. So, but Prabhupada said that there are those who are, he called them, he gave them this name, pratyakshavadi. Just like you've heard of mayavadi. Actually, this is just another kind of mayavadi. Pratyakshavadi. Vadi or vada, this means ism. Vada means, just like we say, you say communism or capitalism, ism. A kind of philosophy, vada. Pratyakshavada means those who base their philosophy on perception. In other words, what they perceive, what they understand through their senses. So, let's find this chapter 1. Now perception, or pratyaksha, it's defined by Śrīla Baladeva Vidyabhūṣaṇ in a work of his called Vedanta Syamantaka. So he stated, Indriyārtha sanikārṣe pratyaksham, that whenever the senses come in contact with their objects, that is called pratyaksha. So when our eyes come in contact with the object of vision, what does that generate? An experience, a visual experience, just as you look around now and you're having so many visual experiences, the green of the leaves, the brown of the tree bark, the blue of the sky. You're seeing so many devotees. This tree has reddish, almost purplish kind of flowers. So as we turn our eyes around, we're having so many visual experiences. Similarly, we're having at the same time an auditory experience. Our ears are coming in contact with sound, the sound of my voice, or Srila Prabhupada's bhajan in the background, or birds in the tree. You touch something, that's called a tactile experience. You smell something, that's called an olfactory experience. You taste something, that's called a gustatory experience. And so these are all experiences. And these experiences of our five senses together, they make up what is known as the perceived world. When we speak of the world, then we're actually talking about our perceptions, what we perceive. So, so we all admit that we're having experience through the senses. But now we have to ask, are these experiences knowledge? Well, they're a class of people. There's a nice term for them. They're called naive realists. So a naive realist is a person who thinks whatever he perceives is real. Now, who's a candidate for being a naive realist? At least children. Little children, simple people. They just look at the world and whatever they're perceiving, whatever they're hearing, smelling, tasting, that's reality. But actually, in our modern world, that's not enough. I was explaining yesterday about the development of European philosophy, so we talked about that. Descartes, that French philosopher, whose slogan was, De omnibus est dubitandum, doubt means everything. So that was about 500 years ago. So as soon as doubt became the basis of philosophy, then there's no more naive realism. Actually, he wrote about his own method of speculation. And you find that very much. He's doubting what his senses, the information from his senses. And actually that has grown into science. What we know as science today, Western science, it is actually coming out of the same doubt. Originally, science, what was it? It was in Europe, in the Middle Ages, there used to be they're kind of like craftsmen, metal workers, and you know, the men who make tools and blades, blacksmiths. This was a technologist, a blacksmith. Even now in India, in the village level, that's about as much technology as they'll see. You see, the local blacksmith. So, these blacksmiths, they wanted to do more. You know, they wanted to make progress in their craft. So they started to speculate, because when you make let's say you want to make a blade of a knife or a sword, they heat up a piece of metal very hot, and then they pound it into a shape, and then to make the blade very hard, then it is plunged into some kind of liquid. It can be water, but they started to think that, well, maybe water, maybe we can improve this. Why just water? Why not prepare some bath out of different kind of substances that may make the blade even better? So they started to speculate that people, when they buy knives or swords, they want them very sharp. So let us think what kind of bath we could prepare that would even make the blade sharper than our own handiwork. So someone got the idea that, you know, there's this kind of root, it's called horseradish. You know, this long white root, very sharp, sharper than green chili. You see, so they started thinking that, well, if we make a bath out of horseradish juice, then you plunge the hot blade into that, because horseradish juice is so sharp, maybe that will make the blade sharper. So this is how science started. So this type of experimentation, now this is a certain kind of experimentation, which in the Latin language was experimenta fructifera. which actually means, interestingly enough, fruitive experiment. And you can all understand what that means, because Prabhupada uses the same word, fruitive. In other words, it was aiming at some result, a sharper blade. So this was how science began. But as they began to develop their technology, especially they were getting from the Arab world, because the Arab world, the Muslims had come in contact with India, and so there were many new ideas coming in, and then they were coming to Europe. Alchemy, how to make gunpowder, all these things were coming. So this was exciting their imaginations. So gradually the direction of the experiments changed from just simple results, you know, how to make a sharper blade. They went to experiments to find out the secrets of nature, to find out what is at the bottom of our perceptions. Because the experiences we get through our senses, they do not reveal the cause. You see, you're seeing something, but by seeing it, you do not see why you see it. You understand? You hear something, but you can never understand by hearing why you're hearing. Why? Why it is that some vibration traveling through the air enters our consciousness. Huh? And you know, just like I'm speaking, why is it that these sounds I'm making are entering your consciousness as words that you understand, that have meaning? You see? Why? You can't understand that by hearing. By hearing these sounds. That question won't be answered. You hear what I'm saying, but you can't understand why this process is going on. So, so at some point, these early scientists, they became curious as to know, why do we have perceptions? What does it all mean? So then they started to make another kind of experiment, which in Latin language is experimenta lucifera. That's very interesting. Because the lucifera simply means light. Lucifer means light, but it also has another meaning, which you all know. The devil, Satan. So you can actually take it either way. Experiments of light or satanic experiments. So this is where the Western technologists, this is where they started to probe into the secrets of nature itself, to find out what is behind our what we see and what we hear. And so in this way, the view of Western man, his view of nature changed. It went from this naive acceptance of everything. Actually, it was also connected with religion, that the answer, the simple answer, why do we perceive everything as we do? Because God made it that way. That's the simple answer, but that wasn't enough anymore. No. So then their whole outlook on this world became very occult. You know? Occult means it's very mysterious. Very mysterious. You can't trust your senses anymore. What you see, that is not the reality. What you hear, that is not the reality. What you smell, what you taste, what you feel, that is not the reality. The actual reality is something beyond that. And so this is how modern science started. So now, this is very useful for us, because the Vedic science is telling us the same thing. The Vedic science is explaining that, in using Srila Prabhupada's own terms, that by pratyaksha, we're only getting impressions. Impressions. We're not actually contacting the reality, the tattva. The tattva. We're only getting impressions. In Western philosophical language, they speak of manifest qualities. Just like these colors. This is manifest qualities. But behind those qualities, there must be some occult qualities. So, the physicists, they have pursued by experiments and investigation all kinds of tests and processes. So they find, they speculate that behind these manifest qualities that we're perceiving, they're what? They're chemicals, they're atoms, there are subatomic particles. You see, they go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. But they've never reached any end. And as I point out in my book, finally it becomes very perplexing for them, very baffling. But in the days to come, we'll get into that a little more. Anyway, so they're trying to find out by pratyaksha what the tattva is, what the truth is behind what we see. Because obviously what we're perceiving, just like for instance, when you perceive, you see, everyone's seen the railroad tracks. So you stand on the railroad tracks, what do you see? They come together in the distance. They come to one point. But is that the truth? Do they actually lay out railroad tracks in that way, that they're pointed together and come to one? See? No, obviously not. That's an illusion. That's an illusion. Then, now we're going to start to show you the problems with pratyakshavada. So science is based, science ultimately, the final test of everything is perception. They say seeing is believing. You know, you can have so many theories, but a theory is only considered valuable if there's some, if it corresponds with something that you can see. There has to be a test, there has to be a proof. Otherwise you can dream any damn thing, any wild, crazy speculation. As I said, you were saying the other day, that there's a rabbit in the moon, or the moon is made of cheese. You can say any crazy thing, make a strange philosophy. But no, scientific-minded people, they want to know what is the proof. And that proof you must perceive. So, the simple example of the railroad line coming together to one point. How do we know that that's illusion? Well, you say, you walk along the track and you look and you see that they're actually the same distance apart. But now we have a problem. Because first of all, you're seeing the two tracks coming together. That is already your pratyaksha. And it's an illusion. Now you say you're disproving that pratyaksha by walking and looking and seeing that they're the same distance apart. You see, this is the problem with pratyaksha. Which perception is right? Which perception is wrong? How much of our perceptions are just creations of the mind? This is very, very problematic. So, we know, Srila Prabhupada tells us, that the conditioned soul has four defects. And one of them is that the senses are imperfect. So, Srila Baladev Vidyabhushan, also in the Vedanta Shamantaka, is listed some of these imperfections. It's a very interesting list. So he says that our senses are able to perceive only objects that are within their range. Just like now, this conch building, it is within our range of vision. We can see it. But behind the conch building, there is a lotus building. How many of you can see the lotus building? Show me your hands. Nobody. Why? Does it mean it's not there? No, it's there. But it is outside the range of our senses, of our vision. So, that's one defect. Then, our senses cannot detect objects that are too near or too far away. Just like a little speck of dust. If it flies in front of my eyes too near, I can't see it. Huh? Because my eyes don't focus that closely. Huh? Or something that's just too far away, like Calcutta. Calcutta is such a huge city. I think it's one of the top three biggest cities in the world. Something like, I don't know, 15 or 20 million people live there. Huge place. But we cannot see it because it is too far away right now, 90 miles away. An object that is too small or too great. Too small means like an atom. Too great means like the whole earth. So something that is either too small or too great, I cannot see. And when the mind is distracted, then even something, an object that's within our range of vision, which we should be able to see, we miss. Isn't it? It happens all the time. You know, you go to the temple because there's so many devotees. So there's someone you're looking for. But there's hundreds of devotees milling around. And that distracts your mind. So you're supposed to meet this person by the pizza stand. And there's so many devotees milling around. And you're looking here, looking there. And then suddenly you hear this voice right next to your ear, Prabhu. And you turn, oh, there you are. He was right in front of you, but you couldn't see him. Why? Not because he was invisible, but simply because your mind was distracted. Also, Baladev Vidyabhusan states that sense objects obscure one another as when the sunshine covers the shining of the stars. Right now in the sky, the stars are shining as they do at night. They're there, the stars and the planets, they're there. But why can't we see them? Because the sky is flooded with sunlight. It covers the little pinpricks of light of the stars and planets. Then there's other defects of the senses which we can mention from Srimad Bhagavatam. One of them is that when we look at a candle flame, then you see a candle flame as one steady object. One luminous object. But actually, it's not. The candle flame is coming into existence, being maintained for an instant and disappearing. One after another, one after another. These flames are coming into existence, being maintained for just a moment, and then going out of existence, and then there's another one, another one, another one, another one. Faster than your eyes can detect. It is also when you see a movie or television, then what you're seeing is a film with many, many images. But these images are going by so fast that your mind can't keep up with it. And therefore, your mind puts it together so that you see a motion picture. But actually there's no motion picture. There's just one little frame. A person is like this. The next frame is like this. The next frame is like this. The next frame is like this. But your mind puts it together as a fluid motion. So this is also an illusion created by our senses. Sometimes due to mirage, we perceive water where there's only dry land. That's, I think, everybody has heard of that, and perhaps has even seen it. We perceive an object reflected upon a moving surface as moving when in fact it is not. If you've ever been to this sea coast or any large body of water at night, and when the moon is in the sky above it, then the moon is reflected on the surface of that water, and you see the reflection all broken up and moving around, scattered. So, but you can actually see the real moon in the sky, that it is one solid white disk. It is not broken and scattered. So we see an object as if it was moving and scattered when it is reflected upon a moving surface, but that's another kind of illusion. Then I've given some examples from Western philosophy also, that sometimes an object appears differently to us. For instance, these trees now, they look to us to be green, but if you come here at night and see them, they will appear to be black. It's the same thing. But according to different circumstances, we can see them very differently. The same object sometimes appear differently to different persons seeing the same thing. For instance, I'll just ask, is anybody here colorblind? You know, some people have a defect where they see green as red. So, two people, one person, if he's colorblind, and another person has normal vision, they will look at this tree together and they will say, oh, what a beautiful tree. But one is seeing the leaves as green and the flowers as red. The other is seeing the leaves as red and the flowers as green. And both are saying, oh, what a nice tree. Very beautiful. Another example from Western science and philosophy is that we're seeing all these forms, but actually, what are they? When scientists examine them, as I say, when they probe into them, then they find these forms disappear. Then they're just atoms in space. And the atoms are everywhere. You know, it's not simply that there where this tree is, or here, this tree, and here's some atoms, and over here, there's no atoms. There's atoms everywhere. There's all kinds of little particles. So, how is it that we see here a tree out of the atoms that are here, and we don't see anything, say, here, but there are also atoms there? You see, so this is a mystery. It's a very difficult problem. And then here's another point, that what we perceive cannot be really what is at the moment we see it. Why? Because perception takes time. Just like the sun. Look at the sun in the sky. So now scientists tell us that it takes 8 minutes for that light to come from the sun to our eye. So when you look at this in the sky, you're seeing the sun as it was 8 minutes ago. So is the sun really there now? Can anyone really say? Maybe the sun just went out. And we're going to find out about it in 8 minutes. So, these are the kind of problems that those who are pratyakshavadis, those who insist that knowledge means what you perceive, or seeing is believing, these are the problems that they have to deal with. So now what about devotees? What about those who follow the Vedic culture? So as I said, Prabhupada explains that we're not actually perceiving the tattva, the truth, the reality of things through these senses, but we are receiving impressions. So what does that mean? That does mean that there is something out there. Our theme is substance and shadow. So impressions means a kind of shadow or reflection. But it does mean that there must be a substance. If you see a shadow on the ground, you can see the shadow of the tree. It must mean that here there is a tree. It must mean that. So that we can accept that although what we're seeing or hearing, etc., it is not the truth, but it is an indication that there is some substance, some reality out there. So then, what is that? So for that we have to turn to the Vedic literatures, to the Srimad Bhagavatam. So Srimad Bhagavatam tells us that this material world, I'm reading a verse from the 11th canto, this material universe may be considered real having nature as its original ingredient and the final state. Lord Mahavishnu is the resting place of nature, which becomes manifest by the power of time. Thus nature, the Almighty Vishnu, and time are not different from me, the Supreme Absolute Truth. So this nature, prakriti, material energy, this is Krishna's energy. So therefore we accept it as real. But then we're seeing it, as we said, we're seeing it, we're hearing it, we're touching it, we're tasting it, we're smelling it. But these experiences themselves, we cannot accept as real, because our senses are defective. So how can we know this nature as it is? So we have to understand that this nature is being manifest, is being maintained. How? By the Lord's glance. The Lord is glancing over prakriti, and therefore prakriti assumes form. So therefore Bhagavatam says this from fourth canto. Krishna consciousness means constantly associating with the Supreme Personality of Godhead in such a mental state that the devotee can observe the cosmic manifestation exactly as the Supreme Personality of Godhead does. So the way Krishna sees this material universe, that is the reality. And so if we can see this universe as Krishna sees it, then we will actually see this universe as it is. So then, of course, the next question is, well, how do we do that? Because it's Mahavishnu who is looking at the material nature. Now Mahavishnu is quite a bit bigger than we are. So how are we ever going to adopt his point of view and see the material nature as he does? Well, yes, that's impossible. That's impossible. But still, there is a way to see this universe, this material world, as Krishna sees it. Can someone suggest how we can do that? Yes, Guru Bhagavan. Huh? To see? As his energy, well, that's a very nice theoretical answer, but we want to know how to do that. Yes. Through the super soul. So by mystic yoga you get in contact with the super soul. I don't think that's going to help many of us either. Yes, Prabhu. Guru Sadhu Shastra. Yes. Shastra Shakshush. This term is given to see through the eyes of revealed scripture. Now these other answers were right, to see the energy of the Lord, but that was the problem I already mentioned. The Lord is seeing His, Lord Mahavishnu is seeing His energy. So how are we going to adopt that point of view? It's not possible for us. And then through the super soul, that's also correct, but how do you achieve the super soul? You see? So our process is that knowledge is received. The mystic yogis, they try to become conscious of the super soul in the heart by a very, very austere process, which is very risky, and anyway is not going to work in this age. So we're only left with the descending process, avaroha panta, that one must take shelter of Sri Guru Parampara, receive the Shastric testimony, Shabda, as it is from the bona fide representative. And then under the instruction, under the order of the spiritual master, we learn to see as Shastra is directing. Now, who is the director of Shastra? That's Krishna. You see, so if you see things as they are explained in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, then you're actually seeing spiritually. Because you're not seeing as your senses are telling you. You're not seeing as your mind is telling you. You're not seeing as your lust is telling you. You see? Shastra, like, just take for example these material bodies. So Shastra is telling us, what are these material bodies? Prabhupada, he often compared the material body to a sack. You take a bag and fill it up with what? Well, if those things that this bag of the body is filled up with, if it was spilled out on the floor, we would be extremely horrified and disgusted. You see, bones and guts and blood and brains and all kinds of horrible things. So now, when one who is in this pratyakshavada conception, just seeing as the senses show, when he looks at this world, he looks at other people and sees their bodies. He doesn't see like that. He's aroused by his lusty desires, so he's becoming attracted to young, beautiful bodies, bodies of the opposite sex, whether male or female. Nowadays, of course, it can be the same sex. So in this way, people are thinking these bodies are very beautiful, attractive, sources of pleasure. This is how you see through the senses. If your vision is directed by the senses and the materialistic mind. And this is what we mean by maya. That is illusion. So Shastra is telling us something completely different. Shastra is telling us that these bodies are not the self. Indeed, these bodies are the evidence of our spiritual disease. Actually, we are soul, we are spirit soul. But in this diseased condition, we accept a material body, which is a place of threefold miseries, and thus we have to suffer. So, if one learns to see this way through Shastra, then one actually sees the reality. So we have to be trained. And gradually, there's a deeper point. The deeper point is that as we surrender to the spiritual master, as we surrender to the direction of Shastra, this is surrender to Krishna. Krishna has made himself available through Sadhu Shastra Guru. So when we surrender to Sadhu Shastra Guru, we're surrendering to Krishna. And as someone pointed out, Krishna's in the heart. And what does Krishna say about himself in the heart? He says that matak smriti jnanam apohanam cha. From me are coming knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness to all living entities, but particularly, Lord Krishna says, for his devotees, tesham evanu kampartam aham ajnana jam tamaha. Tesha means for those, my devotees, then I remove all their ignorance. I become the jnana dipena, the torchlight of realized knowledge. You see, so by going through the trouble of hearing Shastra as it explained by the bona fide spiritual master and applying the directions of Shastra in our life, learning to see this world as Shastra directs, we satisfy the Lord in the heart. And then He removes all darkness. In other words, it's not just a theoretical thing. It's not just theoretical that you're seeing something and then you're remembering, oh, you're becoming attracted, but then you remember, oh, this is maya. Bhagavad Gita says this is maya. I can't look. You see? It's not that you stay like that. That's the beginning. But if one is sincere, sincerely trying to follow the Shastra, passing the test of the temptations of maya, then the Lord, in the heart, He becomes compassionate. And He gives us real knowledge. He actually gives you, as it is stated here, that vision, seeing the universe exactly as the Supreme Personality of God Himself sees it. You can have that same vision. So, and that is reality. That is reality. Now, this is called Adhyatma Deepa, Srimad Bhagavatam. The light of transcendental knowledge. The Lord Himself is that light. So this is our science. Just like I was saying, the scientists, they view this world as a cult. This world is a cult. It's mysterious. It is not as you see it. So they want a light to uncover the darkness. So in the Vedic process of knowledge, that light is Adhyatma Deepa, the light of transcendental knowledge, which comes from Lord Krishna. Now they take another light. I explained this experiment of Lucifera. Experiments of light, or satanic experiments, meddling with the material nature, trying to unlock nature's secrets by laboratory experiments. But what is the result? Well, the Pratyakshavadis, the result is that they become divided into two camps. Among Pratyakshavadis, there are two extremes. One extreme, and you've all heard this word in Prabhupada's books, the Prabhupada uses this term, empirical philosophy. Yeah, that's generally true. But the word empirical actually comes from Greek, empira, which means experience. It's the same thing. They believe that knowledge is to be gained through direct experience. Now, an empiricist, he's not a naive realist. He's not like a child who says, whatever I see, that's knowledge. He understands that our seeing is not perfect. So, you have to improve it by constant experimentation, progress, you see, development, like science is doing. And just like, first of all, they were trying to understand the stars by looking out at night. And then they developed telescopes. And then Galileo looked out and he saw things that are quite different from what one sees with the eyes. And he started just saying, actually, you see, there are different planets, and these planets also have their moons. The moon we see in our sky is a big globe circling around our planet, and everything is circling around the sun. And then the Catholic Church, actually they were preparing a yajna with him as the sacrifice. And then he backed down and said, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it. So everybody knows that story. Yes, so this is the empiricist. He thinks that things are not as we see them. But if we improve our power of seeing, then we will see more and more and more of the truth. And then they hope for that day when I suppose they have a tremendous, you know, 1 mile wide telescope or whatever. And they will finally be able to see to the limits of the universe. They're hoping for that day when their technology becomes so developed that then they will finally achieve complete knowledge. But we don't agree with this, because the Vedas tell us that the senses are inherently defective. If you expand, if your eyes are defective and you expand with a telescope or in the other direction, microscope, you expand its power to see, you're also expanding the defects, the inherent defects of the eye or the ears or all senses. So actually then the mistake becomes greater. It's like in a mathematical equation, you know, there can be a simple small error. So in one of these big long equations, there's been the mistake, 1 + 1 = 3. You see? So that's a small error. But if you compound it, you magnify it by multiplying more and more and more and more using this wrong value, then in the end you're going to get a tremendous error, a huge, huge error. So similarly, if your eyes are defective and you build a great telescope, then what you see is going to be more mistaken, much more mistaken than what you see right now. And that's modern science. So this is the empiricists. They're trying to develop their power of sense perception. Now, opposed to them are the skeptics. The skeptics are people who say, they admit the senses are defective. Therefore they say, there is no use to trying to achieve knowledge. You can't know anything. You see? And I give in this chapter an example of a famous ancient Greek skeptic named Cratylus. Cratylus, he was considered a sage in ancient Athens, but he never spoke anything. He would just sit there, and people would come and see him, you know, and they would try to get him to answer their question. They would ask some question, and all he would do is move his finger. He would just go like this, which meant that what he was saying by shaking his finger like that is that your question no longer has any relevancy. There's no use in my trying to answer it, because in the time that it's taken you to ask that question, you have changed, I have changed, the world has changed, everything is different. So there's no point. He was the one, I was saying how these mundane philosophers, they find fault even with their own gurus. They accept a teacher, and then later on they create their own philosophy, criticizing their own guru. So his guru, his teacher, was named Heraclitus. And Heraclitus taught that you cannot step into the same river twice. Which means if you enter the Ganga, and then you go out and you enter it again, it's not the same river, because it is flowed. But Cratylus, he corrected his guru, saying, you cannot step into the same river once, because the river is always flowing. So even you step into it, that part you stepped into is immediately gone, and there's a new part. So that was his symbol for the whole world. The world is constantly changing. Nothing is the same from instant to instant to instant. So what is the use? What is the use to ask any questions? What is the use to try to give any answers? What's the use to write any books? What's the use of philosophy? That was his philosophy. That's skepticism. What's the use? Nothing makes any sense whatsoever. So this is also coming out of pratyaksha. So these are the two extremes. So one is hopeful, and the other is hopeless. And you can see, just like we learn from Prabhupada's books, there's attachment, raga, and there's dvesha. Dvesha means disgust or hatred. So one tries to enjoy this world, his senses become entangled in this world, he's trying to squeeze pleasure out of sense objects. So as long as he's doing that, he's hopeful. You see, he's enthusiastic. Yes, this world is a very exciting place. We have to learn more, discover more, enjoy more. But after a time, he becomes disgusted. He finds out, I'm not enjoying. I'm working more and enjoying it less. And then finally he says, to hell with it. Prabhupada used to give that, and you all know the story of the fox and the grapes. So the fox was very enthusiastic, jumping up to get the grapes. And then finally he became disgusted and said, ah, they're sour anyway. So these are the two extremes of this pratyakshavad. But in neither case is there any knowledge. This is the real point. In neither case is there actual knowledge. Why is that? Because the cause remains unknown. This whole enterprise of science is to discover the cause. As I said, we're seeing. But why? What is behind what we see? Why? Why are things arranged that we see or hear or taste or touch? Why? So it's an inquiry, that is science, an inquiry into the cause. So through the senses you can never come to the cause. This is a very, very important point, everyone must understand. That through the senses you can never come to the cause of sense perception. Huh? So Now Baladev Vidyabhusan, he gives a very interesting example. He says, if you know the cause, then you can understand why things appear and disappear. So it seems like a very simple point, but it's very profound. He gives the example of a water pot. So here's a water pot. So someone has put this water pot. I have a servant. He puts the water pot there. So now, if I'm thirsty and I want to get a drink and I turn and the water pot is gone, you see, it's not there, then what do I conclude? I know that my servant has taken it away. You see, I know the cause for the appearance and disappearance of this water pot. It's the servant. Now let's say that I somehow had amnesia and I forgot that I have a servant who brings the water pot. And so he's taken it away. And I can remember that, all I can remember is that there was a water pot here. I don't know anything before how it got there. I just know a few minutes ago I looked, there was a water pot. Then if I look and it's gone, then suddenly I have a major philosophical problem. And this is modern philosophy. This is modern philosophy. It's gone. Where did it go? Where did it exist when it was existing? You see, and that's, you get all these problems of, is anything real? And if it is real, then where is it? Is it actually there or is it just in our mind? Now, why all these problems? Because they don't know the cause. They see that things are appearing and disappearing. It's the nature of this world. But why? Nobody has any answer. So just things are appearing and disappearing. And therefore they ask, is it real? And if it is real, where is it real? Out there or in here? And so in this first chapter on perception, I give a lot of quotations about this problem. And finally it comes, the chapter develops to the point where it's shown that all of this science, you see, the scientists, they're very proud of their so-called knowledge, and they come out and they're saying, this is like this, this is like that, science has discovered blah, 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 blah. But because it's all based on this pratyaksha, therefore it's actually all just a belief. It's not knowledge at all. It's just a belief. And here, I just want to read one quotation. This is from a quite well-known British philosophical writer named Brian McGee. And he's writing that the whole of science, of all things, should rest on foundations whose validity is impossible to demonstrate has been found uniquely embarrassing. It has turned many empirical philosophers into skeptics or irrationalists or mystics. Some, it has led to religion. Now what does this mean? It means that there is actually no basis of reality in sense perception. That as these scientists pursue, trying to find out what is there, what is actually out there, they become more and more baffled. More and more baffled. More and more divided in their opinions. And then finally, some actually come to the conclusion that it's all some kind, it's all Maya, they say, you know, the Mayavadi kind of Maya. It's all just a big dream. It's all a big hallucination. It's all my imagination. I am the one who am God, because everything is my hallucination or my dream. Actually, there are some scientists who seriously propose that the universe only exists because we are seeing it. If you know that, you might have heard that old riddle that if a tree falls in the forest and there's nobody there, then does it actually make a sound Or they will even say, does it actually fall if nobody's there to see it? So this is actually a serious consideration in modern science. That if there's no observer, then maybe there's nothing. You see, there's actually nothing. The only reason that things exist is because we're here to see them. And therefore we are the creator. Our senses somehow create this world. So it is a big debate. Is there anything actually there? Is it just all in our mind? So ultimately, this whole of science is based on a big belief, because it's all subjective. If you speak of objective truth, then there must be proof. But there is no proof. You cannot prove that matter exists. You cannot prove, even if you wrap your fist on this harmonium, this is just an impression. You could be dreaming it. There's no, or someone may say, no, it is, it's definitely real because it's all generated in the brain. See, the electrical current is there, and so that's material, that's, you know, that's real. And so all of our impressions are coming out of that real nervous impulse, electrical impulse of the neurons in the brain. But who says the brain is matter? See, the brain is just, it's just a gray lump, which could also just be an impression of our mind. So the brain itself can just be an idea. It's just an idea that I have a brain, that I have a nervous system. It's just my idea that there's electricity flowing through my nerves. It's just an idea. So it's an idea of an idea of an idea of an idea of an idea. So in this way they chase it. There's no objective truth or no objective proof that anything is real in this world. And that's how, why you find in Prabhupada's purports, when he's speaking of these empirical philosophers, he's actually speaking of the Mayavadis. You find very often that Srila Prabhupada says the empirical philosophers, they say that everything is unreal. They negate everything. Yes, that is the ultimate conclusion of this Pratyakshavada. They start off as material scientists, studying everything, accepting that everything is real. And then they come to the conclusion that, well, everything may just be our dream, our idea. It may just be a hallucination. So therefore, the whole of science, as this author Magee says, it is resting on foundations whose validity is impossible to demonstrate. It's just a belief system. It's just another kind of religion, an atheistic religion or materialistic religion. What time is it now? 12 o'clock. So I guess I have to stop. Are there any questions? Yes?
Reality. So, when super soul in our heart is, we are looking at this world and we see also certain reality. So how that glance has to do
just
with...
Just a moment. Some devotees who are leaving. Hi, Bo. Before you go, I just want to announce that tomorrow morning there's a trip to Shantipur, so this class will not be held tomorrow. I think all the morning classes will be suspended for tomorrow morning. So, no class tomorrow, okay? Yes?
So the reality that we perceive through super, when super soul is allowing us to see the world, is the same as the glance of the Lord you mentioned, that he's creating that reality. Is it the same?
Yes, it is the same. Repeat the question. His question is that it was stated that one should see this universe as the Lord is seeing it, and that is reality. So then he's asking, does that mean to see things in the same way as Mahavishnu does when he glances over the material nature? And the answer is yes. Because when the Lord glances over material nature, what does that mean? That means, just as Srila Vyasadeva saw, when he is described in the first canto, that Srila Vyasadeva saw the Supreme Lord, and then he saw behind the Lord his personified material energy, Maya Devi. She is a person. So when the Lord is glancing over the material energy, he's actually glancing at the personified Durga Devi and impregnating her with all of the jivas. So to come to the stage of full Krishna consciousness means to come to the stage of personalism, of seeing the Lord as the Supreme Person and seeing His energy also. The material energy, the living entities, all as persons. That's what it means. Yes?
My understanding of the way Western science and philosophy evolved was that it actually began rather theistic. It was, in other words, the Christian scientists, they were trying to, like, you know, first philosophically explain how God created things, but then somehow or other they needed to be more materially substantial in explaining and understanding, well, how did God? Let's try to see how God did that. And then that in time deteriorated more and more from its theistic to where it became more materialistic. They'll see our scientific information as simply as a faith rather than as a science. And they've come to the point where that it's more scientific to, because it becomes in their values and in their objectives. Therefore, to them, it is more scientific to prove that there is no God than it is to prove that there is a God. How do they justify that?
Well, again, there you see, they're pratyakshavadis. That means they want to confine knowledge within sense perception. And so God is outside of sense perception. So their effort is to try to prove that there is nothing beyond sense perception. But that is a paradox. You can't do that. You can't sensibly argue. If your knowledge is limited to sense perception, and sense perception is, of course, limited, then how can you draw any conclusions about that which is beyond sense perception? It's impossible.
They have to justify their frustration to where they have to take back to the empiricism, philosophy, and mysticism. They have to justify why they take that attitude. Philosophy and mysticism, at this point at least, is also beyond their perception.
Yes.
They have to justify how they justify that.
Well, because, you know, the pratyakshavada, or this insisting that knowledge means sense perception. Why would a person insist that knowledge means only sense perception? I mean, to put it in very blunt terms, it means that his intentions are exactly like those of an animal, because that's animal consciousness. An animal, his consciousness is totally engaged by the senses. He has no, you know, intelligence left over for introspection, for, you know, inquiry into that which is beyond sense perception. That's an animal. So the scientists are actually trying to become animals, and they want to make this modern society into an animalistic society. So they're demons, in other words. I mean, we have to use finally Prabhupada's blunt language. He called them demons because that is their enterprise. To pervert the course of human civilization. To make it, as I was saying the other day, Prabhupada uses this term, royal edition of the animals. Polished animals. That's their intention. Yes?
We can logically understand that. We can't understand that.
world. So therefore we have to use the eyes of that. That requires a faith, because we have to have faith that the version of the Vedas. So how can you rationally explain that aside from the concept?
Yeah, well, actually that will come in a couple days. There is a, just like we were talking about naive realism, so everyone begins there. The atheist, the theist, everyone, we start off as children just seeing the world and accepting what we see, and then we're told that no, it's not like that. And then you start to receive a philosophy, whatever it may be, but it's some supposedly deeper explanation of things that goes beyond your power. Just like the theory of relativity, Einstein's theory of relativity. That theory says that everything is in motion. There is nothing in this whole universe which is actually fixed or static. Everything is in motion relative to everything. Now, we don't see that. No, look, here's my danda. It's not, you know, jittering around. I see it as fixed and motionless. So this is already the theory of relativity. It's already a metaphysical idea. So this is the you know, progress in learning, that one learns things beyond which one perceive, beyond that which we can perceive. So now this is supposed to come to some higher state of perfection of the human being. So in the modern world, that higher state of perfection is this technological civilization. That's what the scientists say. We're right. Why? Because we have sent rockets to the moon, because we've given you television, because we have satellites orbiting, you know, etc., etc., etc. And you know, this could not have been done without these theories. All this technology proves relativity, etc. But again, this is all leading in the direction of animalism. All this technology, what is it doing? It is simply encouraging humanity in our animalistic habits, our bad habits. Eating, sleeping, mating, defending. So there is a Vedic, I actually asked Srila Prabhupada in Chicago in 1975, because at that time there was a lot of, I was distributing Prabhupada's books in the universities with the BBT library party. So I was meeting professors and showing them Prabhupada's books, and that at that time, and I suppose even now still, there was a lot of interest or a lot of speculation about ancient technology. There's some learned people who suppose for different reasons that, for instance, in ancient times they knew about electrical power or they knew about atomic power. And they have some, you know, some proofs, some archaeological proofs that they think demonstrate this. So I was noting how these professors, they would, oh, a Vedic text, oh, that's very interesting. I would like to know about that war at Kurukshetra, if they were really using atom bombs. So we were having darshan with Srila Prabhupada in Chicago. So I asked Prabhupada, that learned people today seem to be very interested in Vedic technology. And as I was asking this question, Srila Prabhupada, he was being poured a glass of water. So he heard my question, and he kind of looked at me, and then he drank the water. And then he looked at me again and said, Vedic technology means Sri Guru Parampara. That's all he said. Put his cup down. Question finished. So, but actually, as we'll explain in a few days, day after tomorrow or so, or maybe the next day, just as in this Western scientific technological knowledge, there are stages of understanding, you know. You start off naive and then you become more sophisticated. So similarly, in this hearing process, hearing from Guru, there are stages of realization. and which bring you to perfection. And of course that perfection is full Krishna consciousness. And there is evidence. There is evidence, empirical evidence, which accompanies these stages. Prabhupada gives a very nice example of the coconut. He says when a coconut matures, I think you've all seen these dabs. So a coconut, as you get them here in India, have a big green casing around it. And then inside that, there's the actual round nut of the coconut. So, when a coconut matures, when it's green, then it's all one thing. But as it matures, then this brown nut inside becomes detached from the green case, and you can hear it. You can shake it and you can hear this thing rattling around inside. So, Prabhupada, it's a very nice example he gives. He says, as one matures in Krishna consciousness, then we become detached from the outer case, meaning this body. And that can be empirically verified. If one gives up meat eating, illicit sex, gambling, intoxication, if one becomes a brahmana in knowledge and in culture, then that is the empirical proof that one is making spiritual advancement. Because you cannot become a brahmana. Like Prabhupada told the story of this Marquis of Zetland who met one of Prabhupada's godbrothers on his visit to London. And so this Marquis, he asked Prabhupada's godbrother, can you make me a brahmana? And the godbrother answered, yes, no problem. You just give up meat eating, illicit sex, gambling, intoxication. And the Marquis of Zetland replied, impossible. So, it's impossible by any materialistic means to become a brahmana. You see, if one remains sunk in this materialistic, this yakshavada, this material knowledge, material culture, then he cannot become a brahmana. He cannot give up meat eating, illicit sex, gambling, intoxication. It's impossible. So that's the empirical proof. Okay, one more question. Yes?
How to put defective conditioned souls, once your Prabhupada lists them, he usually puts the defective senses as the last one, but it seems that the tendency to cheat, to get into illusion and make mistakes comes from the imperfection of the senses. So why does he put the imperfection of the senses as last, or it doesn't matter?
He's asking, in the list of the four defects, he very often finds that the imperfection of the senses are last, and he thinks that the other defects are coming out of the imperfection of the senses. So why is it that the sense imperfection is last? Well, it's not that the others are coming out of the... It's not that first the senses are defective and therefore everything else follows from that. It's that we are defective, first of all, in our consciousness, because we have turned away from service to Krishna, which is our actual, as I was saying the other day, our swarup, our sanatana dharma. So therefore we have come into this defective atmosphere of material existence. So it's, as you said, it's not really that important to place them in this order or that order, to explain one as being dependent on another. We are defective. Yeah, they exist simultaneously. I mean, there is a relationship between them. But it's not, you cannot, I mean, it's not correct to say that everything comes out of our just having defective senses. That's the only problem. No, our problem is much worse than that. Our problem is actually spiritual. Prabhupada called this, our material existence to be a spiritual disease. Material existence is a spiritual disease. So the actual cause of our defects is spiritual. It's not just that our senses are not, you know, fine-tuned enough. Okay, thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.